From WUWM Milwaukee Public Radio, this is Lake Effect. I'm Bonnie North. Wisconsin's Rogers Memorial Hospital opens a new in-house treatment center for some of the world's most severe OCD cases.
These are individuals whose lives have basically stopped. They're being plagued by so many obsessions and compulsions that they're not able to function in school or at work or in their relationships, and really just need assistance 24 hours a day to function.
Then a new book explores the origins of modern Western medicine. It wasn't always a smooth ride.
Quackery comes down to anything you don't like. And so a lot of the things that we think of as quackery in the 19th century were actually mainstream doctors' opinion about some of their competitors in the medical field.
We'll learn the history of Milwaukee's Sherman Park neighborhood, plus we'll get a taste of Betty Bietenz's legendary potato pancakes. Lake Effect comes your way next. First, the news. This is Lake Effect from Milwaukee Public Radio. I'm Bonnie North. Thanks so much for tuning in today. Obsessive-compulsive disorder is one of the better-known psychological diseases out there, thanks in no small part to its frequent depiction on screen, from the TV characters in Monk and Girls, Hannah, to Jack Nicholson in As Good As It Gets. OCD is often played up for comedic and dramatic purposes. But OCD is a real issue, affecting more than 2 million American adults, according to the National Institute of Mental Health. Some estimates say almost 500,000 children have it, and more people are being diagnosed every year. To help meet OCD patients' growing needs, Oconomowoc's Rogers Memorial Hospital opened a new expanded residential treatment center last month. Rogers has one of the largest and most comprehensive OCD programs in the world. Clinical Director Dr. Brad Riemann, a leading expert in anxiety disorders like OCD, joined Lake Effect Stephanie Lecce in the studio and offered some background on the disorder.
Obsessive-compulsive disorder actually is the fourth most common psychiatric condition that we have in the United States, so it's very, very common, typically characterized by what are called obsessions, which are these unwanted thoughts, images, or impulses that generate high levels of anxiety. Common examples might be the fear of becoming dirty or contaminated, doubting whether you did something or did something correctly. Did I lock the door? Did I turn off the stove? Compulsions, on the other hand, are some sort of repetitive act. It could be another mental act. It could be another thought or some sort of behavioral act that is done to try to neutralize that bad obsessional thought or try to get rid of the anxiety that it causes or somehow prevent a bad event from occurring. So in response to contamination, you get washing and cleaning. In response to doubting, you will get checking the door, checking to make sure the stove is off and so forth. And there's many, many other examples. Unfortunately, not only is OCD common, but it is also very debilitating. For the most part, it affects really every aspect of someone's life.
I wonder if it's difficult sometimes to really communicate how debilitating OCD can be when we have depictions of it in the media that probably are pretty imprecise. People kind of throw around self-diagnosing, oh, I'm so OCD about that. Eminem is talking about his OCD in a new pop song. Does that make your job harder?
Yeah, that's a great question. It can. I mean, first of all, OCD is a fairly commonly misdiagnosed and misdefined condition. Kind of the public's perception is anybody who thinks about anything a lot must have OCD. Just because you think about something a lot or just because you do something over and over again doesn't necessarily mean you have OCD. Obsessions, again, are these unwanted anxiety-producing thoughts. So one of the common ways that it can be misdiagnosed or misdefined is, say, someone will get a call saying, oh, my son has OCD. Oh, I'm sorry to hear that. What type of problems does he have? He can't stop playing video games. Now, here's a person who's thinking about video games a lot, playing them maybe 10, 12 hours a day, which is a problem, no doubt. But it's almost the opposite problem. When you ask Johnny, do you like to think about playing video games? Oh, yes, love it. Oh, you know, that's my favorite thing in the world. Do you like playing them? Yep. The only time I get anxious is if my parents tell me not to do it. Whereas if you talk to somebody with OCD about their obsessional thoughts, their fears of contamination or doubt, these are very unwanted thoughts. They're very anxiety-producing thoughts. They would really like to get rid of them. If you ask somebody, do you like or enjoy washing or checking or praying or counting over and over again, they would say no, and what can you do to help me stop? So, you know, the term obsession in particular is something that's just kind of morphed into something that it, from a psychiatric standpoint, it truly is not. And certainly, you know, people who may think about kind of the classic things about, well, I like to be cleanly or I like to be orderly. you know, those people, of course, are going to rarely kind of seek treatment. But overall, the public awareness of OCD, though, is so much greater than it was 20 years ago. And in a way, some of those misperceptions, I think, helps increase some awareness. But we better make sure of our diagnosis before we start treating, that's for sure.
Now, Rogers already had one of the largest and most comprehensive programs to treat OCD in-house. Why open this brand new facility?
Yeah, it's a great question. Need. I mean, that's the simple answer to it. As we mentioned before, obsessive-compulsive disorder is a very common problem. Unfortunately, there are not very many centers of excellence set up to treat it. It's one of these things where if treated properly, in the vast majority of cases, it can be treated quite effectively, but there aren't many places set up to do that. This particular center, we just had exceeded the space that we had, the capacity that we had. And we were very, very fortunate that this property just came up very near where we already were. In addition to kind of expanding the amount of space, we were also able to kind of go in and completely redo it to just really meet our residents and our patients' needs. So it is really set up specifically to help us treat this condition.
This is the third expansion of the program since it was opened in 1999. Why do you think the need is growing so much? Is it because that public awareness is growing and maybe more people feel more comfortable coming forward to be treated for it? What's going on?
Yeah, it's a great question. You know, I don't think there's necessarily any reason to believe that there are more people with OCD now than there was 20 years ago, but there's clearly a greater public awareness. You know, there have been several television shows focusing in on characters with OCD and even reality shows. And these things have increased awareness. People with OCD are very embarrassed by their symptoms typically. And I think some of these programs may have helped them to kind of step forward and say, hey, look, you know, I think I have this problem, and they kind of reach out for help. So I think it's really just more of an issue of awareness and willingness to come into treatment, knowing that there is effective care.
Now, this facility will be able to treat 28 patients in-house. Why is it so important to have that residential treatment versus just having someone come in for appointments?
Yeah, the residential level of care is really meant for the most severe and complicated cases. Thankfully, the vast majority of people with OCD do not warrant this level of care, but perhaps as many as 10% of people with OCD do. These are individuals whose lives have basically stopped. They are being plagued by so many obsessions and compulsions that they're not able to function in school or at work or in their relationships, and really just need assistance 24 hours a day to function. They may need assistance eating. They may need assistance getting dressed, and just that support, and whether it's medical support, whether it's psychiatric support. And so it's really for the profoundly disabled cases. Typically, the vast majority of people can get by with lower levels of care.
Does Rogers also provide that at a different level?
Yeah, we provide treatment at the intensive outpatient level, which is really kind of set up for the vast majority of people with OCD. Kind of moderate up to severe cases are treated in the intensive outpatient. We also have what's called day treatment, where people really spend the entire day with us, but then they return home at night. This is really meant for kind of severe cases. And then the residential, where these people need, again, this assistance 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, are really set up for kind of the extreme cases. So we have really all of the levels of care covered, and really all of the different ages. So we provide the same levels of care for children and adolescents as well as adults.
That's shocking to hear. You often think about OCD as something manifesting in adults. You don't often hear about it in children.
Yeah, it's unfortunately very common in kids. It's not quite known exactly how common, but probably 1% of children will be dealing with OCD. It seems that there's kind of almost two common ages of onset for the condition. One is somewhere around 8, 9, 10 years of age, and then things for them, at least on average, kind of tend to mellow out. And then again, around 20 or so is another kind of area of common onset. It really can hit people pretty much at any age, but unfortunately, kids are not immune to this.
How do you help these patients, especially with something that seems like it's taking over your life?
Yeah. The really good news is OCD is a very treatable condition when treated properly. The window of effectiveness of that treatment, however, is pretty small. But if you get in that, very good things are going to happen. Even if you're just a little outside of that window, things tend to stall pretty quickly. But the treatment of choice for OCD is something called exposure and ritual prevention. We had mentioned OCD really has kind of two parts, the obsessions and the compulsions. And as a result, the treatment really has two parts as well. Exposure targets the obsessional thoughts. Ritual prevention obviously targets those rituals or compulsions. And in a nutshell, what exposure and ritual prevention is a series of very individualized exposure assignments where we are going to be asking someone kind of in a very gradual, repetitive fashion to kind of reintroduce themselves into their feared situations and then not do their typical normal ritual, whether it's a mental compulsion or a behavioral compulsion, following that. So for an example, we talked about contamination before. People with the fear of becoming dirty or contaminated commonly won't be able to touch things in their normal daily environment. So maybe they avoid touching doorknobs. And if they do touch a doorknob, commonly they'll have to go wash. So the obsession is this fear of becoming contaminated, say, by the HIV virus. And the ritual would normally be washing and scrubbing of the hands, sanitizing the hands, whatever it may be. In an exposure and ritual prevention model, we would ask someone to begin to touch doorknobs and not wash their hands. Now, obviously, that is far, far easier said than done. And there is a real kind of method to the madness, if you will, as to how you kind of lead up to that point. Bottom line is again, sticking with our doorknob example, there are doorknobs that are far harder for someone to come in contact with and not wash their hands than others. We would start with these perceived easier doorknobs. An example might be their bedroom doorknob versus their little brother's bedroom doorknob, which they think is dirtier because he's always wiping at his nose or something like that, versus, of course, a bathroom doorknob versus something that would be out in public. So there's all these different steps. There might be 10 different doorknob exercises, for example, getting to the point finally of being able to use really any doorknob like anyone else would.
The message you're giving is this is treatable. This is something that doesn't have to run your life.
Correct. As we said, it's a very common problem, a very debilitating problem, but also a very treatable problem. The biggest concern for someone with OCD is just really trying to find somebody who knows how to do this. And unfortunately, that is the number one disadvantage of this type of treatment, just trying to find providers who are trained and experienced in doing this. Believe it or not, we probably have anywhere from 85 to 90 people with OCD on our campus from the ages of 8 to 80 today, from all over the place, and that is because of a lack of providers. And one of the things that myself and some of my professional colleagues have really tried to do over the last 10 to 20 years is expand that, try to do a lot of trainings. We'll be going to Tampa, Florida here in a couple of weeks and doing a training for professionals, licensed professionals in the state of Florida, because there's no reason to be competitive about this. There is way too much suffering going on and too few providers.
You mentioned before that you've taken that accumulated experience and knowledge and treatment know-how and used that to inform how you designed this facility.
Yes. We mentioned before that people with OCD are embarrassed by their symptoms, and as a result, they can also be embarrassed by their treatment. Meaning, if you're going to have people going around and touching these certain things or doing certain things, they do like privacy. And in the design of the Cedar Ridge facility, there are far more what we kind of call breakout offices for people to kind of go in and do this work with clinicians, but in private, which is important for them. We want to make sure that we respect their dignity and try to do this in the most humane way possible, and that is in part by giving them their own space to get this work done.
And now you have it.
And now we have it, and we're thrilled.
Well, Dr. Brad Rieman, thank you so much again for coming in.
You're very welcome. Thank you.
Dr. Brad Rieman is the clinical director of the OCD Center at Rogers Memorial Hospital, based in Oconomowoc. Its new residential treatment facility in Summit for OCD patients opened last month. Well, we've all heard of snake oil salesmen, but what's actually in that potion? Well, hint, it's not snakes. We'll find out more when Lake Effect returns right after this short break. You're listening to us on WUWM, Milwaukee Public Radio. It's Lake Effect on Milwaukee Public Radio. I'm Bonnie North. Mom is the first person many of us turn to when we're sick. Mothers have that certain magic touch and seem to know just what we need in order to feel better. Moms have taken on the role of house doctor for centuries. They had to learn medical practices from their own mothers and from other women because they were not allowed into traditional medical schools. But there were alternative medical practices that invited women to participate. Mainstream doctors named these practices quackery. Erica Janik, the author of Marketplace of the Marvelous, The Strange Origins of Modern Medicine, explains to Lake Effect's Eleanor Peterson exactly what quackery is and why women were drawn to it.
It's funny, when I first went into this, I really thought that quackery had a very clear definition. But the thing that I really discovered going into this project and learning more about the 19th century is that basically quackery comes down to anything you don't like. So there can be a variety of reasons that you don't like something. And so a lot of the things that we think of as quackery in the 19th century were actually mainstream doctors' kind of opinion about some of their competitors in the medical field.
So then how did you go about researching this quackery?
So I went about doing it just kind of reading about what was actually going on, what people were doing for their medical treatment. I discovered a world that was really diverse in terms of how people were seeking care for their various ailments. It was really a process of really discovering that there really weren't a lot of trained medical doctors in the U.S. This is a very big country, and so the doctor could often be pretty far away. They were mostly concentrated in urban areas, and so people were relying on all kinds of different methods in order to heal themselves. And so I started looking at letters and newspaper articles, also reading home medical guides. We think about those diet and health books that we see all over the place, grocery stores, bookstores, even at the airport. Those books have been very, very popular for centuries, and people in the 19th century were buying them too. So I started reading a lot of those and just seeing what kinds of things were people proposing about what was causing disease and what were the various ideas of how to cure it.
So this really started to pop up in the 19th century, or did it carry over from the 18th century and from Europe when people were immigrating from Europe to America?
People have been using alternative therapy really for centuries. The very earliest colonists to North America, we're using all different kinds of remedies as well, home remedies, what we think of as patent medicines that they purchased. And so it really was a carryover of centuries-long tradition, and immigrants were bringing some of those traditions from Europe with them as well. But what happens in the 19th century that makes it kind of notable is that these kind of movements start forming. So there were these kind of disparate types of healers all over the place offering all different types of remedies. But in the 19th century, you find them kind of banding together, kind of forming around a particular theory of disease and how to cure it. And so they become kind of larger movements that sweep over the country.
Speaking of banding together, I'm also finding a lot of parallels between women's rights and irregular practices like hydropathy. And why did alternate medicine appeal to women? Is it based off of the kind of the rural health care? If they had to wait for a long time for a doctor to come, did the moms and wives have to kind of take over? Or how are women connected to the different medical practices?
Kind of a combination of those things. So for centuries, women had really been acting as their family's primary caretaker. They were really acting as kind of the nurse and the pharmacist and the doctor, really doing anything they can to help keep their families well, as well as helping neighbors give birth to babies, lots of midwives. But in the 19th century, you find these alternative groups kind of forming, and they're very welcoming to women. And one of the reasons that they are is that women have a hard time getting the medical attention and care that they need. Most of the mainstream doctors are men, and kind of social propriety means that a lot of women are too embarrassed to actually go see a doctor. And even when they did go see the doctor, he often wouldn't examine them because he was so worried about offending their sensibilities. So a lot of women were really suffering, and suffering unnecessarily, according to these alternative healers. And so as these groups are forming, they really see an opportunity in women. They think that by welcoming them in, both as patients and practitioners, that this is a way to really grow the audience for their theory, but also a way to solve kind of a major health problem in that women aren't getting the attention that they need.
I've also saw a lot of celebrities throughout the book, ranging from people like Mark Twain to President Andrew Jackson. Did these people have a role in these medical practices like endorsements, or what role did these people play?
A combination of those roles. It depends on the person, of course, but you do find that basically all of the boldface names you can think of from the 19th century, these people were trying an alternative remedy. That didn't mean that they weren't going to see a mainstream doctor, too. You know, that's something that's kind of been very common throughout our history, that people go see one kind of doctor, but they're also trying a bunch of things on the side. And so you find all different kinds of famous people in the 19th century are, you know, suffering from sickness and want to be well, so they're trying all of these different things. And some people did become very outspoken advocates for a particular type of healing. One of those was Harriet Beecher Stowe. She wrote Uncle Tom's Cabin, but she also loved the water cure. And she wrote about it, as well as her sister, Catherine Beecher, also loved the water cure. They were very big proponents of it. You also find a lot of writers who were using some of these therapies were then writing about them in their novels. They weren't necessarily writing these novels as, you know, advocacy pieces for a particular type of healing, but you'll find that a character actually uses homeopathy, or a character goes and gets their head phrenologized.
And that was, I found that fascinating, too. It's just that the different celebrities wanted to get their heads examined to see how accurate it was.
That's right. You know, I mean, I think we all kind of are want to know about our characters and our personality. You know, we have all of these kind of existential questions about who we are and what our potential is. And so it's really appealing to find a therapy like phrenology that seems to promise to unlock all of those secrets that are in your head. And so people would go over and over again trying to better understand themselves, how to make themselves better people. Mark Twain goes over and over to get his head phrenologized. He tends to make fun of it when he does write about phrenology, but he keeps going back and he keeps trying it. So, you know, that's an interesting, like, dichotomy there of him. You know, he thinks it's kind of ridiculous, yet he can't seem to stop going and seeing what they say about him.
And then speaking of the mind and brain formation with mesmerism, it seems to have come with a lot of drama, including King Louis XVI, who ordered a committee to be formed to investigate Franz Anton Mesmer's practices. What was it about this medical practice that created such a problem?
So one of the things that people were very, very concerned about is that a lot of the mesmerists, their theory was basically that there was this invisible fluid, animal magnetism, that was kind of flowing throughout the universe, in and out of our bodies, and they would kind of direct this invisible fluid into you and kind of move it around your body, and this would help cure your disease. Now, most of the practitioners of this form of therapy were male, and a lot of their patients were female, and they would cause this, what they called a crisis, when they were actually performing the therapy, and people would kind of become unconscious or go into convulsions and fits. And people were really nervous about what these male mesmerizers, what kind of like mind control they were having over their female patients and what they could be causing them to do. And again, that social propriety idea, were these men taking advantage of these women? They really had no idea. And so the King of France, his wife, really loved mesmerism. And he was like, what is going on in there? And so he does form this committee because he thinks that mesmerism sounds absolutely ridiculous. So he puts together all of these very great French scientists and an American, Benjamin Franklin, to investigate this theory and try to figure out, is it actually real? Is something actually happening? Because it's so very popular in Europe.
How did the mesmerism tie into Christian Science?
So there's all kinds of mental healing. They kind of start with mesmerism, and then it takes on a variety of different forms throughout. You know, mesmerism starts in the late 18th century, and then in the 19th century, it kind of morphs into different things, and there was a man named Phineas Parkhurst Quimby who believed that all disease was basically just a figment of your imagination, that you were having kind of wrong thoughts, and that if you replaced those wrong thoughts with good thoughts, then happiness and health would result. And he became very, very popular as this mental healer. And there's a lot of modern ties to what he's saying, basically telling you to think positive, be optimistic. And one of his patients was Mary Baker Eddy, who went on to found Christian Science. And she used a lot of the ideas that she learned from Quimby as part of her new healing faith. So you do find this really long continuum from 18th century Vienna all the way to late 19th century Boston, where Christian Science really takes off.
Milwaukee didn't seem to really escape this either, because Milwaukee had its own Reinhardt brothers who sold medicine to, quote, cure private and secret diseases particular to men. So how did they get to the men, and were they successful?
So I love the Reinhardt brothers. I mean, they're horrible. It's really, so these are very clearly the quacks that we think of, the people that are just kind of bilking people out of their money and preying on innocent people. So it was twin brothers and then an older brother. And they ran a business in Milwaukee called the Wisconsin Medical Institute. And men, generally, would come to see them, and no matter what complaint you came to them with, they would diagnose you with a sexual dysfunction. So if you said you were having heart palpitations, they would say, well, that's because of your sexual dysfunction. If you said, you know, you're having excruciating headaches, well, that's also a sexual dysfunction. People could also write letters to them. You didn't have to travel to the Milwaukee office. And they had kind of a character that they called the master specialist, who would diagnose your problem through the mail. And of course, it was a sexual dysfunction. And he would apply all different kinds of remedies and try to figure out how much you could actually afford. That was a big part of it. They kind of did a little background check on you. And then they usually gave you some kind of electrical device, usually an electric belt or an electric vest, to heal you. It actually took several years for the state of Wisconsin tried to shut them down for many years. And when they finally succeeded, the Journal of the American Medical Association actually came out with an article congratulating the state for finally shutting these guys down.
So they ran them out of town, and where did they go? Does anybody know?
Unfortunately, they actually just went to another state and set up another business. This was kind of a continual thing. They were actually from Minnesota originally, and they had run a fake business in the Twin Cities. They got run out of Minnesota, so they came to Wisconsin, set up another business. So what we think happened is they just moved on to another state and unfortunately started bilking some other people out of their money.
How have these developed over time since the 19th century? How did they become more credible?
So what you find is that a lot of these people kind of on the fringes, these quacks in the 19th century, were proposing some new ideas about what disease was and how to cure it. Things like drinking water, things like exercising, eating fruits and vegetables. These were kind of out there crazy ideas in the 19th century. And as the century wears on, though, you find mainstream medicine kind of starts to adopt some of these ideas. And as medical science is progressing and we're learning actually more about disease, because before the late 19th century, we didn't know about germs. We didn't know that insects could transmit disease or that human contact could cause disease to spread. But as we're kind of making these discoveries, some of these ideas that had seemed really out there all of a sudden started to make a little bit more sense. Now, a lot of the people that were proposing them in the 19th century took them to rather extreme ends. So hydropathists, the water cure doctors, they recommended that you drink water, but they also recommended that you basically soak in cold water, take showers in cold water. It was like an 18-hour day of water treatments, which is kind of an extreme end. But the idea of keeping clean and drinking water is a good idea. And that became part of public health campaigns by the late 19th century and early 20th century. And you find this happening with a lot of the ideas that these alternative healers were proposing.
Well, this is just absolutely fascinating. So, Erica Janik, thank you so much for talking to us about your book, Marketplace of the Marvelous, The Strange Origins of Modern Medicine.
Thank you.
Erica Janik is the author of Marketplace of the Marvelous, The Strange Origins of Modern Medicine. She'll be at a book signing at Boswell Books on Downer Avenue tomorrow night at 7 p.m. She spoke with Lake Effect's Eleanor Peterson. There's more information about the book on our website, wuwm.com/lakeeffect. Coming up next, we'll talk about Sherman Park. It's one Milwaukee neighborhood that's trying to get the diversity equation right. Lake Effect returns in a moment on Milwaukee Public Radio. We're back with more of Lake Effect. I'm Bonnie North. Thanks for joining us today. Milwaukee is one of the most segregated cities in the country, according to varying accounts. A report released last year by the Greater Milwaukee Foundation says the city is the most segregated among 15 similar areas. But the study also notes that Milwaukee is sixth out of those regions for diversity. While the city as a whole works to improve the mixing of cultures, there's one West Side neighborhood that stood out for such efforts for decades. Sherman Park, bordered by 35th and 60th Streets and North Avenue and Capitol Drive, has long been held as a beacon of racial diversity in the city, even if that's relative compared with the city's broad divide. Of course, this integration, however imperfect, didn't come without challenges, a bit of serendipity, and a lot of hard work on the part of its residents. In the 1960s, as the city and country's racial tensions were running high, the neighborhood's residents began organizing and later turned the Sherman Park Community Association into a force to be reckoned with. Author Paul Geenan, a former Sherman Park resident himself, captures these stories in the new history of the neighborhood, Sherman Park, A Legacy of Diversity in Milwaukee. He explained to Lake Effect's Stephanie Lecce what people think of when they consider this West Side neighborhood.
They think a neighborhood that has had a strong voice in what happens and very politically active. And they think of it as a diverse neighborhood. And they also see it as a neighborhood that's constantly under challenge, constantly dealing with problems and coming up with solutions that are from the community itself.
What set the stage? What was going on nationally and within Milwaukee that the Sherman Park, quote, pioneers, if you will, were responding to?
Well, in the 60s to the 70s, that was a time of great disruption in our communities. That was the Vietnam War. We had three assassinations, and there was a very, very lot of racial segregation going on at that time. And what was happening in Sherman Park was that, first of all, African Americans were migrating to Milwaukee in huge numbers for the jobs. And they were being forced to live in crowded conditions in a very segregated part of Milwaukee. So there's this whole push. They wanted better housing. At the same time, in Sherman Park, there's a lot of redlining and real estate practices that tried to keep the area very, very white. And as African Americans started moving in, if one or two or three African Americans moved onto a block, then all of a sudden everybody in the whole block over a period of a couple of years would leave.
Right, that white flight.
There was a white flight. There was another big thing that was happening, that was the freeways were being built. And in 1964 was when the first freeways were built. By 1970, they had cleared the land from Sherman Boulevard all the way to the Marquette Interchange. And at that time, when land was allocated to freeways, it wasn't a very fair process. People were not notified of when hearings were held. It was closely held information where the center line of the freeway was, where it was going to be located. And it had tremendous impact on property values and not a good impact. It really, people, if your house was close to the freeway, you felt that your property values were decimated. So you had two factors that were forcing a lot of turnover in the Sherman Park neighborhood. So who moved in? Families, say mixed marriages, families that had adopted interracially, and white families that wanted to live in a multicultural environment, and African-American families who wanted to live where people were a little bit more open and amenable to living in a diverse environment.
So it's interesting to me then, how did these families, these pioneers moving into this neighborhood, how did they know that this was going to be a place where they could all live together? I mean, why didn't Sherman Park go the way that so many other neighborhoods did in Milwaukee and become very, very segregated?
Well, this wasn't a planned thing. I interviewed over 60 residents, and generally the story that they tell is I was driving down Sherman Boulevard, and it took a left, and I saw these wonderful elm trees, and the houses looked beautiful, and man, this is where I wanted to live. It was a kind of a focus of people who were very active and involved, and then they attracted others. I might say that St. Catherine's was a real catalyst in Sherman Park. The Social Ministry Committee was the people on that. That actually started in 1965, although Sherman Park records say they started in 1970. But sometime in that period, you had a very active group of people at the St. Catherine's Social Ministry Committee. So they also recruited people to live in Sherman Park. So it was a combination of people stumbling on it and just being impressed by the wonderful values in the houses and people who came who were attracted to live with their friends.
From there, the Sherman Park Community Association was formed. How important was this organization in preserving that diversity and also fighting these issues?
Well, it was critical. The Sherman Park Community Association organized around housing, around the freeway, and around education. So those three issues, the schools, fighting the freeway, and fighting housing segregation, were critical, and the organization was key to making it happen.
Well, how did they defeat the freeway?
Well, that's an interesting story. First of all, it took 10 years. And you have to remember that most of the people in Milwaukee supported the freeways. There was a referendum that – and or 56% of the people said, yeah, it's a good idea. The key to defeating the freeway was that some professors at UWM uncovered the fact that they were designing the freeway to be of such scale so that during rush hour, people could travel at posted highway speeds. So when that fact became uncovered, and then people started saying, why are you tearing down my neighborhood just so you can drive in from the suburbs at 60 miles an hour, that turned things around. Then all of a sudden, public opinion shifted against the freeways. Another thing that was mentioned by one of the person I interviewed was that about the same time, people started looking at all the houses that were being taken off the tax rolls and started wondering if maybe this was not such a good idea.
I want to talk about that other element that the association and the neighborhood really worked toward, which was to get rid of housing segregation and housing discrimination. Tell us about some of the practices that realtors and real estate companies were using at that time to keep Black families from moving in. Did this happen in Sherman Park?
Yes, it did, and it happened a lot. The realtors would blanket an area with leaflets saying, we have a buyer for your house. And then sometimes in conversations, they would mention names of buyers that had very ethnic-sounding ring to them. And the whole idea was to frighten people to move. And it was totally illegal. But the Supreme Court finally, in the early 70s, said that housing testing was legal. It was proof that steering was occurring. And
now, what's steering?
Steering means that if you're white, they show you houses in a certain part of the neighborhood. If you're African American, they show you houses in another part of the neighborhood. One of my close friends, still to this day, he and his wife, they're a mixed couple, and he remembers how when he moved into Sherman Park, how the first house they bought, how he realized later that they were steered into an area that they probably wouldn't have bought in. They would have bought. They ended up moving just because of this practice of realtors deciding where you should live. So the Supreme Court ruled that you could do testing, and that's what really broke the back of that. And so the testing was what kind of turned things around.
Tell me about the testing. You have some great stories from people who actually participated in these tests and what they observed and ultimately were able to use in courts to reverse this practice.
Right. It was a process where hypothetical couples were created. So you'd have a white couple with a certain demographic and income and things like that. And they'd carry microphones, cassette tape recorders and microphones. And they would go and look at a house. 30 minutes later, another couple who would be African American or mixed, same demographic, same everything else, would go and look at the same house. And people who participated in that said this was a really, really a great experience. It was like the 60s. We were out there at the front. That was very exciting, covert. What was interesting was that people were discriminated against. They didn't even realize that they were being steered. It was only when you compared what the realtor said in one situation against the other that it became very clear that there was steering going on. One of my friends said that it upset her so much that she couldn't do it after a while. It just got under her skin. It was very disturbing.
How diverse then and how inclusive did Sherman Park become? Was there a lot of mixing between the races or was it still pretty separated between the east side of Sherman Boulevard and the west side of Sherman Boulevard?
It was never perfect, and it's not perfect today. There was always meetings and conversations. There's a lot of anxiety over the fact that the eastern part of Sherman Park was very African American, while the western part was very white. And how can we make that? How can we fix that? And that never really did get resolved. There are today areas like, for example, Grant Boulevard, where I raised my kids, was very integrated when we lived there. there, which would be in the 70s and the 80s. Teague Whaley Smith lives in Grand Boulevard today, and he says, you know, the area is starting to become very integrated. A nice mix of families are moving in, both black and white. So it's never perfect, but the goal is always out there.
What changed as we got into the 80s? What started to happen in Sherman Park?
Well, in the 80s, we had two things changed. One is drugs and one is the media. At least that's what I'm saying. In the 80s, the media started giving much more attention on news broadcasts to crime reporting. And there is a perception that crime had increased. Secondly, there was an actual physical peak of drug arrests in the 80s, about 1984, actually. But perception is reality, and there was this perception that crime was rampant and things were going to bad places. And so you had some people dealt with that different ways. Some people left, some people stayed, some people coped with it, and I kind of talk about that in my book.
And so then where is Sherman Park today?
Well, they're still out there. They're still working hard. I was at many of the meetings, particularly last fall, and I'm here to tell you that they're just as dedicated as they were 20, 30 years ago. The issues are different. They're working on different issues. And I also did find out that there's this whole faith community that is alive and well in Sherman Park. So you have these kind of communities within communities that are in Sherman Park today. My core point is that this is the way we think America should be. If America looked like Sherman Park, we would be in a better place because it's a dynamic of people of multiple cultures, problem solving, and creating really creative solutions is what we need here in the country. And we wish that the whole country looked like Sherman Park.
Well, Paul Geenan, thank you so much for coming in and giving us this little primer on Sherman Park.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Paul Geenan is the author of Sherman Park, A Legacy of Diversity in Milwaukee. He's a former president of the Sherman Park Community Association, a retired entrepreneur, grandfather, and community activist. Geenan has also written Schuster's and Gimbel's, Milwaukee's beloved department stores, and Milwaukee's Bronzeville, 1900 to 1950. He spoke with Stephanie Lecce. We'll take one more break and then travel to Palmyra, Wisconsin to sample some of the area's best potato pancakes. Stay tuned for that, plus another episode of our Islands of Milwaukee series when Lake Effect returns on Milwaukee Public Radio. We're back with more of Lake Effect now. I'm Bonnie North. Betty Bitens turned 91 years old this month. It's a birthday you may have missed, and you'd be forgiven if you don't recognize her name. But if you've ever eaten in the Jefferson County community of Palmyra, there's a good chance you've sampled her handiwork. For almost 70 years, Betty Bitens has been the area's unofficial potato pancake queen. Now in her 10th decade, Bitens has decided to make sure her iconic recipe remains a part of Wisconsin cuisine for years to come. Lake Effect's Mitch Tyke explains.
It's a typical afternoon in the kitchen at the Trout House, the restaurant that's part of Rushing Waters Fisheries in Palmyra. There's a lot on the winter dinner menu that executive chef Nate Chappell is preparing, things like pecan-crusted rainbow trout and blue crab mac and cheese. But right now, the attention of Chappell and the others in the kitchen is drawn towards an accompaniment.
Yeah, I always did this to get it the right size.
Consulting on this important task is Betty Bitens, for whom Betty's famous potato pancakes are named. Chappell and his team follow Betty's recipe closely, but as she looks on, there's always room for tweaking.
Maybe use a trifle more on there than I think.
Okay.
Before the night is out, the Trout House will have dished out upwards of 200 potato pancakes, which requires multiplying the measurements in Betty's original recipe. But of course, Betty was also used to making large batches of pancakes in her decades of work in restaurants around Palmyra. Sitting in the Trout House's dining room, Betty shares a secret. Her iconic potato pancake recipe did not originate with her.
Well, there was a restaurant up at LaGrange on Highway 12, and it was a supper club, and I was a waitress there. And the gal that was doing the cooking had to go for an operation. And so the boss, Fred Judy was his name, I'll never forget his name. he came up to me and he said, could you take over the cooking while Irene is gone until she gets back? And I looked at him and I thought, I'm not a cook. I'm just a waitress. So I said to him, I said, if you got enough confidence in me to think that I can handle this, I says, I'll try it.
She says it was her boss's potato pancake recipe, and it took her a while to master it.
He'd come into the kitchen every Friday night, and he'd have a pancake, and he'd say like this, another pinch of salt, he'd say.
That was about 65 years ago. And Irene, the cook for whom she was filling in, got married and quit her job, meaning Betty was now a professional chef. She stayed at that first supper club for a few more years, went to work at another restaurant. Eventually, she and her husband bought a resort in Rome, Wisconsin, where she refined the recipe a bit more. Still a few years later, the couple bought the Nightcap Inn in Palmyra, owning it for a quarter century. She sold that restaurant a couple of years after her husband died, but was coaxed out of retirement to work at still another restaurant called The Fireside. Betty says she can't remember exactly when she realized people were seeking out her potato pancakes.
A lot of people asked for the recipes. Of course, I always give it to them. And then it was in the Milwaukee Sentinel a couple of times, and it was also in the Jefferson County Union, and a lot of pictures and everything. It was in the paper, too, of the chefs and myself. And almost got an album of all my pictures.
So it's not technically a secret recipe, but still, while many people can follow instructions, not everyone can credibly recreate Betty's famous potato pancakes. Enter chef Nate Chappell and the evolving Trout House restaurant.
We kind of were in the R&D phase of developing the pancake that we wanted to use here at the Trout House. You know, I worked the retail store here on many, many weekends, and people would come through just on their way to the Nightcap because they've been going there forever. And the potato pancakes, all about the potato pancakes. Your potato pancakes have a following in Wisconsin, completely have a following.
But for the Trout House to become the official keeper of the potato pancake flame, the kitchen staff had to acquaint itself with the technique that Betty has honed over 70 years or so.
At the first place, you got to use Idaho potatoes. Well, Idaho potatoes are a drier potato. And then you grind them and you put them in a sieve and you squeeze out the water as much as you can. And then you grind your potatoes and then you grind your onion, but you grind your onion separate from the potatoes, you know, in a different bowl. And then it's flour and salt and a little baking powder and eggs, and mix it all together. When I had my business, I had certain pans made. They were real thick, heavy pans, and used those for frying.
Chef Nate Chappell says more than the recipe itself, it's that technique that Betty has imbued that is the key to the potato pancake legacy and his philosophy in general.
The method is the most important part, and I tell people that all the time. People ask me, you know, well, how long do you put it in the oven for? Well, you put it in there until it's done. You do it until it's done the right way. And that's what, you know, we're all up against as chefs and cooks is, you know, doing it the right way, the right method.
Still, at the end of the process is what it tastes like. And Betty and her latest protege agree that the ideal potato pancake is browned, crispy, and not overly greasy. But in the Trout House's kitchen, to get to that point also requires patience. If there's anything 70 years of frying have taught Betty Bitenz, you can't rush a potato pancake. For Lake Effect, I'm Mitch Tyke in Palmyra.
Yeah, they look good.
Yep.
Yeah.
You'll find pictures and a link to more about Betty Bitenz and her potato pancake legacy from WUWM.com/lakeeffect. A couple of weeks ago, we kicked off a weekly segment called The Islands of Milwaukee that seeks to connect and engage seniors living across the Milwaukee area with a question of the day. Well, here's the next installment.
The Islands of Milwaukee. This is Maureen Towie from the Islands of Milwaukee.
This project is taking us all over the city, and we're finding that Milwaukeeans can be curious and creative regardless of age. We're learning a lot from the older adults we're meeting. So today, our question of the day is...
What is something you wish you could learn?
Okay, what I would like to learn would be how to parallel park comfortably. That would be it.
Medicine. I learned about physiology.
I would like to learn more about world religions.
We found a lot of people looking to unlock some music inside of themselves.
I would like to take singing lessons, and in order to extend the range of my voice.
I wish I could learn to play the harp. Yes, I play the piano, and I think it would, I want one of those Irish harps, and I would love to learn to play it.
In addition to these weekly broadcasts, all the answers to the questions of the day are contributing to a big exhibit at City Hall in September. So anyone that answers these questions is a collaborator for us. They're helping us to explore a more vivid version of Milwaukee. Do you know an older person, a friend, neighbor, or family member who is living alone and might be underconnected to community? Call the Islands line to get the question of the day and call us back with the answer. Help us create a more connected Milwaukee with one simple phrase. I have a question of the day. Would you like to hear it?
You can participate in the Islands of Milwaukee project by calling the Islands hotline at 414-678-1673 or by visiting islandsofmilwaukee.org. And I'm Bonnie North. Thanks, as always, for tuning in today. And we'd also like to thank everyone who contributed to our winter membership drive. Thanks to you, we made the goal. We very much appreciate your generosity. Lake Effect returns tomorrow and every weekday morning at 10 on listener-supported 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee Public Radio, NPR in Milwaukee. Stay tuned. Fresh air is next.